I think we shall begin. Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome, as we're saying, to class number 15. And we're getting towards the end, but always a pleasure to see everybody. And welcome back, Dr. Mark, to continue our fascinating series on Rav Shaul Lieberman. As Bavakasha, Doctor.
Thank you. Yes, I think I'll play 16, maybe 17 classes. The post I mentioned a few times finally appeared. You can check it out on the Sfarim blog. It's about interesting things about gelatin, the history of gelatin right. in America. Also, because I mentioned it a few times, the OK. If you're interested, I have more in part two about the history of the OK, but it's a fascinating phenomenon. Basically, the originator of industrial kashrus is a man named Abraham Goldstein with the OU. And then he went to the OU, from the OU to the OK. And this is a chemist, but a balabas, not a learned, rabbinically learned Jew, obviously. Well, it's just obviously if you know the history, but a scientifically learned Jew. But he got the crazy idea running this thing, which he started called the OK Laboratories, that he knows more than the rabbis. It was almost like karite, because he determined that if there's any treif in a product, that makes it treif. Issues of bittul and change of status. I mean, even if you don't believe that gelatin's kosher, as many rabbis didn't, they never rejected the idea that there's such a concept that food, look, like I said at the end of the post, you can certainly chew on your non-shechted leather baseball mitt, and no one's going to think that that's violating any issur. So you can read about how things got to be so bad that the Agudas Rabbanim, including Rav Ezra Silver, basically had to put him in Cheirim. And so the OK was regarded as like an outlier hashgacha by the rabbis, although it had a large following among the laity. But it wasn't until it was sold to Rabbi Bero Levi, you can't really regard it as an authentic, I think, Orthodox hashgacha in the way we usually think of it. I mean, he went after the OU, and it's just a crazy, crazy story of lay people, him and then his son. And I've been in touch, by the way, his grandchildren have been emailing me, who are mainstream now. But I mean, it's the idea that usually we think of the masses telling the rabbis they don't know what to talk about because they think the rabbis are too strict and mishagas in the way of chumrah. But here you have someone who couldn't learn in a traditional sense, telling the rabbis that they're a maratzim in terms of, it's like that expression, like this famous story I told you about Rebbetzin Soloveitchik, that her son told at the RCA convention when she came back from the hospital, Tanya, she found all the milk and meat dishes together in the sink, and she screamed at them, they're trafing up her kitchen. And this is at least the way the son told it, I'm told. The Rav said, well, the Shulchan Aruch says it's okay. And she said, quote, again, I wasn't there to hear it, but this is what I'm told Chaim said, your Shulchan Aruch is going to trafe up my kitchen. That's basically what Abraham Goldstein was saying. Your halachas are going to feed everyone to tarfus. So please, if you're interested, check it out.
I forgot to thank you at the beginning. It was fascinating, Eric. I just read it on Saturday night. Really, really fascinating. Like all the articles are, but yes, I'll just second that. The history and his eraser from the OU.
Erased from the community.
Erased from the OU history. Industrial history, institutional history.
Yeah. And in part two, I will deal. I know Asher Reimer, who sponsored some classes. He's a Talmud of Reb. I don't know if he's with us tonight, but he's Talmud of Rav Gershuni. And in fact, I saw the wedding picture. Rav Gershuni was the Seder Kedushin. So I will show you more new information about Rav Yehuda Gershuni, the son-in-law of Rav Lazer Silver. One of those figures I mentioned, one of these Gaonim, who just sort of never made it. I once asked one of his students why he didn't make it. And he said that he had no strength to stand up for himself. He was a very modest type of guy. And sometimes in order to make it, you have to be willing to put your name out there and make a big deal of yourself. But if you're a natural anav, a modest person, it's sometimes hard to make it. And she even a miracle called Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael. I think that's where Asher went to. And the Frimmers studied there. And interesting character. Gon Shebegonim, like so many of them. I was listening to the class, and right at the end last week, there was this brief mention of why I call it the Palestinian Talmud. So we spoke a little bit about that. I want to show you something now. Hold on a second. Because I just looked around a bit for some things and for some reason I'm not um, I'm not seeing my screen here. I might have to send this to Rabbi Kelman again. I'm not seeing any things on my screen. So
if you send it to me, I can try to post it. Here it goes. Here,
oh, here you go. Okay. Do you see that? Do you see the screen now?
Oxford.
Okay. Very good. Okay. And I, Leib Moskowitz from Bar-Ilan University, he's a big expert on the Yerushalmi. And I just Googled it. I was curious to see what they call it now, because Neusner, we'll get to Neusner today, he refers to it as the Talmud of Eretz, of the land of Israel. And that's another way it's called. But Leib Moskowitz, who's hardly a Palestinian, you know, PLO person, he refers to it as the Palestinian Talmud. And Lieberman refers to it in Hellenism and Greek and Jewish Palestine. Lieberman, unlike Boy Aaron, was a big Zionist. You can't get any bigger than that. During, I think it was the Yom Kippur War, he gave loads of money, of his money to the state of Israel. But they call it, that's what it was called, Palestine, Roman Palestine. By the way, the question, you know, we should ask ourselves is, why is it called Yerushalmi? It wasn't, it was composed in the north, in Galilee. It wasn't composed in Jerusalem. Jews were not living in Jerusalem there. So I don't know exactly why. They say that, one second here, they say the reason is to give kavod to Jerusalem. I don't know if that's the real reason. It's also referred to as Talmud, as I said, Eretz Yisrael, Marava, things like that. But there's no political element, if you want to call it the Palestinian Talmud. I spoke about Solomon Seitlin and some of his crazy ideas. And Professor Basser, who was with us, emails me that he thinks that I'm too hard on Seitlin about his Second Temple period. I can't really speak as with any authority. I can speak about his medieval stuff, which is only 5% of 95% he wrote his Second Temple, that it is, he jumps to unfounded conclusions. I don't think there's anything of lasting value there. But Professor Basser, who is an expert in the Second Temple period, he gave me a number of examples where he think that Seitlin's points are of lasting value. So I take back what I said, that other than the Dead Sea Scroll stuff, that it's all of basically of antiquarian interest. And but what can I say? He was some character. And all you have to do today, you can see it online. It used to be that you had to go to a library, and who gets the Jewish Quarterly Review? I used to go to Seton Hall Library near my house. That's where I first discovered it, the Jewish Quarterly Review. And like I said, look at any issue in the 50s and 60s, and then you get cited. Two more things, my friends. Daniel writes to me something interesting, which I did not know. So here we go. If you recall, I cited Rabbi Mazuz's weekly Torah sheet a couple weeks ago, where he discussed the notion that Haman, where the Gemara describes, the Midrash, but it's in the Targum Sheni, I think. But I think it's also in Midrash, where Haman is describing how bad the Jews are, that if a fly flies in their wine, they'll throw it out. But if you Achashverosh touch it, then they won't drink it. And Tosfos derives a halacha from this. So how could Tosfos derive a halacha from Haman? And the answer of Mazuz says is that, well, it's the rabbis are putting these words into Haman's mouth. So that's the halacha. It's not that he actually said this. Daniel, although it's not the same thing, he calls my attention to something of interesting. In Erevin 63a, they have a story there where Rabbi Eliezer says that Rabbi Eliezer had a disciple who issued a halachic ruling in his presence, and Rabbi Eliezer said to his wife, "I'll be surprised if because of lack of kavod Torah, if he lives out the year." And then the Gemara continues that, well, this is what happened, and it's referring to this individual is called Yehuda ben Gurya. And the Gemara asks, why, you know, well, what do we need to know? Or what it tells us, why do we need to know who this person is? Shelo tomar moshel haya. So you don't say that this is just a parable or a story. Point being that, as Daniel points out, here we see the Gemara acknowledges that they recognize that certain stories, if they didn't tell the name, and say we're actually referring to a specific person, you could assume that this isn't a real story. It's just a tale or something to give you a moral lesson. So that's quite an interesting source there, Daniel. Thank you. And the last things of the introductions, I want to get back to what was asked last class because I did a little research on this. And I think Dovi Safier, is that how you pronounce it? I'm not sure, but he has a lot of interesting things on Jewish history for really giving me the solution to this issue. One person asked, as I recall in the comments, because we were talking about Rabbi Greenwald, Leopold Greenwald of Memphis, the author of Columbus, the author of the Kobol Avelos, which was until recently the standard halachic text on Avelos. But Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't like that book. He just said negative things to say about it. So whenever you have a situation like that, you have to wonder, what did Rabbi Greenwald do to upset Rabbi Soloveitchik? And I told you this. The story about that perhaps Rabbi Greenwald was referring to Ramosha Soloveitchik. He was upset that they delayed the funeral. Well, the source of this, I didn't remember exactly. It's in a Sforim blog post from June of 2017 by Brian Schwartz. And he notes that in Kobol Avelos, page 12, Rabbi Greenwald says that it troubled him, he had tsar, when he read in the Morgan Journal of 12th of Kislev that a Rav Gaon Mefursam had died in Brooklyn on Friday, and they waited until Sunday to bury him because they said it's for his kavod. And Rabbi Greenwald's all upset with this, that said that they didn't even wait for his sons. They didn't wait for his sons and daughters. They just said that on Sunday there would be more people to come pay their respects. Now, Brian says that this apparently is Ramosha Soloveitchik. The problem is that Ramosha Soloveitchik, he points out himself that he died earlier in the year. He died in January of 1941. Now, I also pointed out that that it didn't make any sense for that same reason. But second of all, I said, he's talking about a gadol in Brooklyn. Not to mention the fact, I didn't even know until I looked at the Kobol Avelos, he says that they didn't even wait for the children. Well, the children of Ramosha Soloveitchik were at the funeral. So what it clearly is referring to Ramosha Soloveitchik. Furthermore, Brian makes a mistake here. He says that 12th of Kislev is December 2nd. It's not December 2nd. It's December 7th, 1941. So how does that help us? Well, Dovi Safier writes to me as follows, without even knowing with about the mistake on the date. He says, because I didn't say last week the actual date. I just said December. He said, I'd assume the funeral in question was that of Rav David Leibowitz. David Leibowitz from, he was a Torah Vadas, then they had a bit of a falling out, and then he moved, he started Chavetz Chaim. I'd assume the funeral in question was that of David Leibowitz. He lived in Brooklyn and died on a Thursday night in December of 1941 and was buried on a Sunday. I know this offhand because the funeral was on December 7th, 1941, the day of the attack on Pearl Harbor. So there you got it. It's no question it's a furniture of David Leibowitz. Anyone check the Morgan Journal? You can get the microfilm at New York Public Library and other big libraries. And so the newspaper report would have been on Sunday. That would have been the day of the funeral. He also points out that there are two other famous people who died on Friday or Thursday evening that a funeral is on Sunday, the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Aaron Cutler. And we said Rav Soloveitchik as well. Rav Soloveitchik died on Thursday and was buried on Sunday. Incidentally, I had to correct the Wikipedia. The Wikipedia had him passing away on Friday, which was not true. Thank you very much, Dovi. And thank you, Brian, for raising the issue. Brian has sent me so many important stuff over the years, but in this case, I just make the correction. Back to Hellenism and Jewish Palestine. It's funny this time of year to speak about Hellenism and Jewish Palestine because all we speak about on Hanukkah is Hellenism. And that's what Hanukkah is all about. You wouldn't know this today if you go out there. Hanukkah is probably the most celebrated holiday, more than Passover. Everyone lights candles. But of course, most of the people, unfortunately, in American Canada lighting candles are themselves Jewish Hellenists. They don't have the bit of an understanding of what Hanukkah is about. No one understands it. Even Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib can wish us happy Hanukkah if they knew that Hanukkah was like the big Zionist holiday and retaking back the land. Maybe they wouldn't. But we all know that it's against Hellenism. What a lot of people don't know, by the way, that it's not just against Hellenism, it's against Hellenizers. The war began with killing of a Jewish Hellenizer on a sacrifice. And the war was not just against the Syrian Greeks, it was against their allies. The if you look in the Book of Maccabees, it describes a forcible circumcision of Jewish children, although there's a scholar who was, that's what everyone says, but there's a scholar who's recently argued that that's, it shouldn't be read as forcing them shouldn't be read as actual literal forcible circumcision. But we know there are lots of Jewish Hellenizers. And that's what the holidays against. So what's going on here? What's with all this Hellenism and Jewish Palestine? Well, I think there's Hellenism and there's Hellenism. Obviously, just like in America today, even the most Orthodox are influenced by their environment, by their by what's going on. During Hanukkah, we have a lot of concerts, right? The very notion of Mordechai Shapiro and Lippa Schmelzer and all these people getting up in front of crowds, screaming crowds and singing their songs, this never happened in Europe. This never happened 75 years ago in America. This is a response, obviously. This is the Jewish, the Orthodox model, alternative to what goes on in the regular culture. And that's every society that Orthodox traditional Jews have ever lived in. He's always, most of the time, it's been intellectual adoptions, but you go back to medieval Spain, for instance, you have cultural adaptations. You have this all over. I mean, I shouldn't just say intellectually. Have it in all its ways. That as the non-Jews go, the Jews go with certain differences. So there's Hellenism, as we'll see, which was either infiltrated, maybe against the rabbis, but others that the rabbis wouldn't have had a problem with because it wasn't thought to be dangerous. So when you think about Hanukkah, there's different types. There's, you know, the type of Hellenism they were opposed to was a very different type of Hellenism than some of the things that we might see use of, let's say, Greek terms, et cetera. We'll see some examples of it. You know, so I take my class. Well, this has been a while, more than a few years ago. So, the occasion happened just Hanukkah. I was talking to someone about this and it reminded me, so I'll share it with you because it's worth knowing that around this season, we just finished Hanukkah. The people in California, may you're a little behind us, but certain person was giving a talk to this group I was with, and he was going on and on insisting that we all make a mistake. We don't call it a menorah, we call it a menorah, but it's really a Chanukiah. And that's a mistake and mistake. And I didn't say anything. I didn't know how to, I held it in. But as I told this other person in my town, a Chanukiah is not a tradition. It's not part of our Masorah, to use this YU centrist Orthodox term. It's Chanukiah is an invention of modern Hebraists, maybe 100 years ago or so. There's no traditional Jewish text that uses the term of Chanukiah. It's menorah. There's two types of menorah, the seven branched one, or six with the middle, and then the eight with the one in the middle. There's no such thing as a Chanukiah. There is, by the way, a Hanukkah. The word Hanukkah is also used to refer, for example, Hadlika to Hanukkah. The word Hanukkah is also used to refer to the object that you light, but not Chanukiah. So I'll just share that little tidbit with you. What I want to do now is I want to pick up with the few things we're looking at, Hellenism, Jewish Palestine. I'm just calling attention to some things that caught my eye. And I'll pick up with something as well that one of our listeners last class mentioned, take us back to Greek and Jewish Palestine. But I'll just pick up where we left off. Page 84. Lieberman writes about the old question, big debate. When was the Mishnah published? What does that mean? What does it mean to be published? He says, or edited, you could say, he said, and when was it written down? there clearly, as he shows, people had private texts of the Mishnah. Even though it's Torah Shabbat Be, Torah Shabbat Be means that it's put in a published form. We'll talk about what published means in a pre-printing era in a second. But we know that people had private texts. We have plenty of sources for that. For the private use. But when Lieberman asks on page 85, when was the Mishnah published? And what does it mean to be published? He says there's two ways you can speak of publishing. First of all, you have many copyists, and you have them copy it and send it out. That's one way. The second way of publishing something in antiquity, he points out, is you deposit an original copy, like in a library or in a temple or something like that, and that's kept as the authentic text. So then it becomes official. That's when it's published. And he points out that if you look in the Gemara, they often have disputes. Not once do you ever have a case where they say, well, let's take out the Mishnah and let's look at it. If we're having a debate, what it should read. And that shows you that in the Talmudic times, we don't have something that's published in writing that was sent out to everyone. On the other hand, they did have private texts. So he speaks about... and he says the written notes did not have any authority, official authority. So he says that you can't say the Mishnah was published in writing, but he talks about that there was an oral Mishnah. You can say that that it was in existence. You already had a fixed text. And then when it was written down, okay, that comes later. But it was committed to memory. The Tanaim recited it. That's what you have to speak about. This is different from other people who thought that it was already literally written down in the days of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. But he says if it was officially written down as an official work, then how come they never say, bring us the Mishnah and let's see exactly what it says. That's what Lieberman argues. On page 101 and 102, this is the last thing I'll mention in Hellenism. He has a whole chapter there, the alleged ban on Greek wisdom. It's often said that the rabbis banned the study of Greek wisdom. The Tosos even says that. And Lieberman argues against this. He says that if you look in all the rabbinic sources, there's no hint of a ban on the study of Greek wisdom or of Greek language. What it is, he tries to show in his chapter, is there was a ban on teaching the children. Distinction was made between the children who shouldn't be exposed to this and people, Talmid Chachamim, older people who needed because they had to interact with the government. They could learn Greek and also Greek wisdom. But it's the children. And that's a theme we will see throughout Jewish history. When they wanted to ban philosophy, the Rashba and others, they always kept... a distinction here. Younger people banned from older people, they're allowed to access it. Later, when they would ban the study of Kabbalah, they'd ban it for people under a certain age. And this is a famous chapter of Lieberman, which I think has become accepted wisdom. Last class, although I finished the Greek and Jewish Palestine, which is, as I said, now put together into one volume, one of you, I'm sorry, I forget who it was, called attention to page 92. So let me talk about page 92 for a minute. In this chapter, Lieberman speaks about that there are certain practices which had their roots in popular belief and superstition. And when I say popular beliefs, we're talking about non-Jewish beliefs. Quote, the rabbis were compelled to tolerate the practice, but they succeeded in endowing it with Jewish character. That is, practices that were popular among the masses, that made its way into the Jewish community. If the rabbis couldn't uproot it, as he says, they had to adapt a Gentile custom adopted by the ignorant masses so as to suit Jewish requirements. They sometimes had to draw upon heathen folklore popular among the masses and recast it in a Jewish form in order to instruct and edify those same masses. So I think the idea is that sometimes if you can't get rid of this practice and it doesn't violate Jewish law, or go against basic Jewish beliefs. Instead, you can leave it the way it is and just try to take away any negative aspects to it. I think the person who wrote that in was a little surprised about this, that about this, but I don't think it's any need to be so surprised. None other than the Meiri says the exact same thing. The Meiri gives the explanation of Zugot, that you can't have pairs because it's dangerous. The Meiri didn't, because demons, the Meiri didn't believe in demons, and he didn't believe it's dangerous. And he thought that the rabbis also didn't believe this. So then why do the rabbis acknowledge the existence of Zugot? They even give an explanation as to why. You have to give an explanation. Why on Pesach we have four cups? What about Zugot? And what the Meiri says is the exact same thing Lieberman says. Lieberman doesn't quote the Meiri here, but the Meiri says that the masses were taken by this superstition of Zugot. And since it doesn't violate Jewish doctrine in any way, they didn't see any reason to uproot the practice. Instead, they offered it, they kept it in and tried to keep it away from, pagan ideas. And because sometimes you can't fight the masses. If the masses have a popular practice, many people in your communities, you probably have people walk around with red ribbons. Red ribbons, incidentally, it's in the Tosefta that it's Darchei Amori. And you can look at Lieberman's commentary there, where he quotes the various sources on this. Today, since you don't have any pagans who are, I know Rav Schechter goes crazy about it, but if you don't have any, we don't have any pagans anymore who are busy with the red ribbon. Most rabbis, I think their attitude is okay if they want to do it, if they want to believe it. It might not help, but it doesn't hurt either. And we have a number of practices like that. The Rambam, as I already pointed out, the Rambam said, when we dealt with Igros Machle Rabbanon, the Rambam says that if people write holy names, names of angels, on the inside of mezuzah with the words, well, that's destroying the mitzvah. That's attaching their superstitions to a mitzvah. That has to be uprooted. But if they want to write it on the outside, which, by the way, we do, in our mezuzahs, they have it. The Rambam says, well, that you can let them do, because if people want to believe in nonsensical things, if it doesn't affect the practice of the religion in any essential way, dogmatic, doctrinal way, then you're allowed to, you can let them do it. And that's what Lieberman's saying. The same idea that if people were so attached to something, we do the exact same thing. And even more yeshivish people I've seen are now doing it. The young people are addicted to the Super Bowl. I know it from my own family, my own kids. And so what happens? They don't fight, at least in our communities, they don't fight against the Super Bowl anymore. You know what my kids' school does? During halftime, because the game is not problematic, really. Bittul Torah, maybe. But, there's a lot of Bittul Torah going on. So, but they don't want to see the halftime show. So during halftime, you're supposed to call in. There's a Rebbe who gives a shiur during halftime. And that's like a big thing now. So they've acknowledged that the people are going to watch the game. And there's nothing really wrong with that. But during halftime, then you can have learning or something like that. That's what Lieberman's talking about. You deal with the reality that you have, that the people were involved with these things. And instead, you try to... You take away the negative aspect, add something positive if you can. In fact, none other than Rav Avraham ben Harambam, well, I shouldn't even just say the Rambam, is that really much different than what the Rambam does with sacrifices? The Rambam says people were so attached to this form of worship, they couldn't remove themselves from it, so the Torah acquiesces to this ritual of sacrifices and instills positive spirituality, holiness, in the idea of Karbonos, of sacrifices, even though this wasn't the initial intention, and this was a compromise. This was an acquiescence because the people couldn't relate to God without this physicality of sacrifices. This is famous, of course, from the Rambam, but this is elaborated on by the Rambam's son, Rav Avraham ben Harambam. He says in his commentary on Bereishis, this wonderful new edition from Rabbi Moshe Maimon of Lakewood, if you look up, he goes even further. By the way, the Rav Eliel ben Amozig does this with a lot of mitzvahs. He says that the Torah was responding to what the way that the people were had practices, like they wore fringes or that sort of thing. So the Torah makes it holy, but it keeps the same practice. But if you look on the Avraham ben Harambam's commentary on Bereishis, Genesis, pages 353, 354, he says as follows. He says, you know that Yibum, the Levirate marriage, Achal Pi Shehimi Mitzvah Satorah, even though this is a mitzvah in the Torah, he minhag b'mei kedem. This is an ancient practice that predates the Torah. This is what people did in ancient times. V'hishira oto ha-Torah, the Torah kept the practice of Yibum. And then he says, and this is also found, b'ktzat shara mitzvos b'li safek. Without a doubt, this is found in other mitzvos in the Torah as well. And in the note, there's a long note by Rabbi Maimon. He points out that this is a basic theme in Rav Avram ben Arambam, that the Torah adapted earlier practices, pre-Torah practices. I don't know if ritual is the right word, but practices. And got rid of the pagan element to it and instilled put in a Torah element to it. So that's the same thing we're speaking about. That's what the rabbis are doing, exactly what Rav Avraham ben Arambam says the Torah itself did. I want to now show you an example of how you can take this model that Lieberman was using of knowing the realia and knowing the languages and knowing the facts on the ground that allow you to understand passages in the Talmud and the Mishnah and Tosefta. He does this page after page. He shows you, first of all, he explains words that are unclear. He thinks that he derives them from Greek or Latin. He shows you, he explains concepts there. Or the background. Why are the rabbis, when they criticize something, what are they criticizing? When they speak about idolatry, well, what's this particular idolatry? What's the, again and again, in addition to explaining sugyas, he'll explain to you just the halacha, what it's referring to. But he also will explain, and this is his real value in many ways, he comes to it with so much knowledge of what life was like in Roman Palestine and later, but in particular in Roman Palestine, the Greek heritage and the Latin heritage, he can illuminate so many passages. So let me give you an example, because it's not really relevant to Lieberman, but I think you'll find it interesting, and I wrote about it, so some of you might remember, but it's the same exact way. And I think it's an example of how, here we're going to look at a text in the Shulchan Aruch, how we can understand a text through using outside knowledge. Let me see here. I want to show you a passage in the Shulchan Aruch. Here you go. This is Hilchos Sukkah, the laws of Sukkahs. And it says as follows. This is 649, number 4. Ginot ha-tse'irim, the fields of the tse'irim. What are the tse'irim? If you look at this is a safari, the English translation, it doesn't even translate it, it leaves it out. I don't know who did this translation. I think it's individuals contribute. But you'll see the translation is wrong, but they don't even translate what ginot ha-tse'irim are. It says, ginot ha-tse'irim, fields of the tse'irim, the chayotze bahem, and similar. Nibatei Shamashehem, mutar litol misham lulav ushar minim mitzvah. So fields of the gardens of the tse'irim and similar things from the batei shamashehem, you can take a lulav from there and also the other minim, the arba minim, to make for the mitzvah of taking lulav and esrog. They translate this: one is permitted to take a lulav or other of the species for the mitzvah from the gardens or similar things at their place of worship. Now, where is this say at their place of worship? They're translating mibatei shamashayim as meaning their place of worship. That's not what it means at all. That's not what it means at all. What it means is mibatei shamashayim, it means the houses of their attendants. That is the attendants of the tse'irim. We'll see where this comes from in a second, or the buildings maybe of their attendance. It has nothing to do with places of worship. Okay, so the first question is, what is Tse'irim? The Shulchan Aruch says, who are the Tse'irim? It's not just that people today don't know what it is. If you look in the Feldheim translation of the Mishnah Berurah, the Shulchan Aruch, he doesn't know what it is either. They translate it as gardens of the Tse'irim. Okay, so that doesn't tell us what it is. But the Taz, if you take a look at the Taz on this halacha, he says as follows, quote, Eini yodea perusho. I don't know its meaning. Avahu inyan mimisharte avodas alili. But it has something to do with people who were involved in idolatry, that is, priests of idolatry, which that's obvious from the context. I tell you, even the Shulchan Aruch doesn't know what Se'irim are. He's quoting it, but he doesn't know what it is. I know he doesn't know what it is, because we'll see why. But he knows enough because that it's something having to do with idolaters. Because as we'll see in a minute, he's quoting from the Or HaShem, word for word. So you don't need to know exactly what the Se'irim are. You just know they're, just like we saw with Lieberman, Rav Hochstein said, you don't have to know exactly what the Gemara means or Mishnah means when it talks about the stove that they describe to cook. But, you know, it's referring to cooking. So do we need to know exactly what the Se'irim are? It's some sort of idolatrous group. But I'm interested, and Lieberman would be interested. Now, this passage in the Shulchan Aruch is just recording what appears in the work of the Or HaShem or Aaron HaKohen of Unel in Hilchos Luav in the name of the Ritva. And what does it say? It says there that you can use that which grows in the gardens of the Tse'irim. And then it says, V'chayotzi bahem mibatei hakomarim. And similarly, that's from the houses of the priests. So now we have priests, referring to Catholic priests, but we also have Tse'irim. So the Tse'irim are not, they're different than the regular priests. I think, by the way, our Israelis can correct me. If I'm not mistaken, you would not say, I think the plural of Komer in modern Hebrew would be Kemarim. But in rabbinic literature, it's usually Komrim. If you look at the Beit Yosef has Komrim. So Shama Shehem was put in by the censor, the Shulchan Aruch, worried about the censor. So this is a halacha. It tells you can take a luav, another minim from the Garden of Idolater. Actually, if you look at the Aruch HaShem, it doesn't just say Ginot HaTzeirim, it says Ginot HaTzeirim the Hadorshim. That is the gardens of the Tzeirim, the young ones, and the Dorshim, the ones who preach. So what's that all about? I don't know why the Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote that. Well, so this is to show, this is to think in line with Lieberman. You do a little investigation, and lo and behold, you want to know the Tse'irim are? You heard of the Franciscans? The order of the friars, they're called the Little Brothers or Friars Minor or Minorites. That's what they were known as. So when in rabbinic literature, in medieval rabbinic literature, when they refer to Tse'irim, they're always referring to the Franciscans. So what are the Dorshim then? Well, there's another group. The Dominicans. The Dominicans, it says it right here on Wikipedia, the official name of the Dominicans is the Order of Preachers. So now we understand what the Or HaShem was saying when the Or HaShem says the Ginot of the Tse'irim and the Dorshim. Because they had all these monasteries, the Franciscans and the Dominicans. And are you allowed to then go to their grounds? And if you see a Rava there, can you use it? And he says you can use it. And really, what becomes a Komrim is separate. Komrim is just an addition, a priest also. But this is exactly the sort of approach we're speaking out. I was surprised to see that Rabbi Shavel, in his edition of the Vikuach of the Ramban, right at the beginning, it refers to that in attendance at the Vikuach of the disputation of the Ramban, it refers to the Se'irim and the Dorshim. And in his note, Shavel identifies the Se'irim properly as the Franciscans, but the Dorshim, he doesn't know what they are. In his English translation, he speaks about the Franciscan scholars and preachers. But that's the Dominicans. By the way, my university is neither Franciscan or Dominican. We are Jesuit. And if you know anything about the Jesuits, our current Pope is a Jesuit. And throughout history, the Jesuits have been better than these other groups. Not so much in Poland, that was a problem. But in the early years in Spain, they were better to the Jews. And it was Cardinal Bea of Italy, a Jesuit, who was really one of the major movers behind the Vatican II. When Pope Francis became Pope, I was asked by Tablet to write something because I'm at the Jesuit University. So I wrote a piece you can just Google it. Is a Jesuit good for the Jews or something like that? And you'll read all about history of Jews and the Jesuits. So that's my little contribution there with like the Lieberman method to explain to you. You have to know the outside. This is not something that you can learn just inside the yeshiva walls to know what the tzi'irim are. And again, it doesn't affect the halacha. If you ask the Shulchan Aruch, does it really matter if it's Dominican or Franciscan? It's an Oved Avodah Zarah of some sort. That's what's important. And it doesn't affect the halacha, but I think certainly when you're doing a translation, as Feldheim, and now we have other translations, and it says Se'irim, at least Feldheim knew enough just to not to write the young ones, because what sense does that make? But it's nice to at least know what it means. Okay, let us return now. In the second half of the book, the Spiro and Shochet book, they divide it into the first part dealing with his works, the second part dealing with his character, and more personal. So that's all very interesting, a lot of recollections, and gives a sense of who he was, only because this has become part of lore, the relationship of Heschel and Lieberman, and especially Heschel at the seminary. You speak to old-timers at the seminary, and they'll tell you it's a classic example of Acharei Mos Kedoshim to you, that in Lieberman's lifetime, he was like, when Lieberman was at the seminary, he was like on the outs. They didn't give him a good seat. And there was official designations of where you sat. Supposedly he didn't get a good seat in the show. But the seminary was all about Finkelstein and Lieberman and Talmud study. And here Heschel doing his Hasidic stuff and marching with Martin Luther King. Now you look back and most conservative Jews had never heard of Lieberman, never heard of Finkelstein, never heard of Ginsburg. It's totally forgotten. But everyone knows Heschel, and for good reason. But Heschel, because his message has lived on, and some of his stuff is great. I understand that Lieberman wouldn't have tolerated patience for this, but the Shabbos, if you've never read the book, the Shabbos or the Prophets, this is great stuff. So as I said, the seminary lore is that they did not have a good relationship. And on page 192, they do say that the relationship of them was distant. On the other hand, it wasn't so distant. They would walk together. They even describe some of this here. It's not like they was completely negative. They were enemies, anything like that. Far from it. Even Lieberman and Seitlin. I looked again at my files. There are a few more letters from the YU collection there, and they're after Lieberman's rebuking letters to Seitlin. And you see, he's friends with him again. So you can rebuke and be friends. But the big thing, at least they make the point, and it makes sense, is that Lieberman didn't, first of all, he didn't like the showiness, and also the Lieberman was a conservative. He was an admirer, you can read here, of Eisenhower, Republican. And when Heschel, as I said, publicly and aggressively opposed continued U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, this is the sort of thing that someone like Lieberman, just like Rabbi Soloveitchik, they supported the war. And they were afraid of communism. Both had lived under communism, or seen it up close, I should say. Lieberman lived under it. Did the Rav, as far as I know, he never lived under it. But Lieberman lived under the Soviets, and everyone from that part of the world knew what communism was. And to identify with these radical movements, to be walking in the anti-war, all that sort of thing, it wasn't really something that, as they say here, this sort of activities would lead him to view Heschel's public advocacy as unwise, a form of grandstanding. Also, he probably viewed Heschel as a popularizer rather than a serious academic and textual scholar. It's true that Heschel is a popularizer, but if you look at some of his early stuff, it's really first rate. He does a dictionary of medieval Jewish philosophical terms. He has an essay, which has been translated to English, "Did the Rambam Think He Had Achieved Nevuah?" Prophecy. And you see there that that Heschel was on top of all the scholarship of the Moreh. He could have been just an academic scholar of Jewish philosophy or of Hasidut, but he wanted to be like a Rebbe of sorts, and that's his great influence. You can see there's some videos of Heschel online. As far as I know, there is no, I could not find a video of Lieberman speaking, but there are videos of of Heschel. I also want to call your attention to an essay that appeared by Daniel Boyarin. We've spoken about Daniel Boyarin a great deal. Here it is. Oh, no, sorry. That's Neusner. The next. Okay, I'll get to Neusner in a second. He was supposed to have a series. Once a month, he was supposed to write about issues of Talmud. So far, he's only written two pieces, one on Lieberman and the other on Dimitrovsky. But it's called A Way of Reading the Genius. He mentioned something that I think you'll find it of value. The Eusebius, the 4th century Christian thinker, bishop of Caesarea, he speaks about how the Christians were persecuted. And he mentions that the Jews were agitated and bothered seeing how the Christians were being persecuted, executed. The Jews were a tolerated religion in the early years before Constantine, before the Christianity took over. It was the Christians being fed to the lions and the things like that, not the Jews. Jews had it better in Rome in the early years after the Common Era, after the temple was destroyed. You know, by the way, even during the times of the temple destruction, even during Bar Kokhba, Jews were not persecuted in Rome. There was a complete separation. Lieberman, in discussing this, says as follows. Their feelings can be very easily understood. The Gentiles refused to sacrifice to the idols and suffered terrible tortures because of their refusal. Lieberman discusses how he has a whole article on this, and then he responds to criticisms that showing halachic sources that how non-Jews are also obligated to against idolatry, and therefore if non-Jews are given the choice that they have to bow down to these idols or involve themselves in Roman pagan religion, that no, they under Emperor Julian, for instance, they're halachically obligated also to withstand it. So Jews, seeing this, as Lieberman says, they would see pious Gentiles who suffered martyrdom for their refusal to offer sacrifices to idols were deemed deserving of one of the noblest ranks in the future world. And what is Lieberman? Lieberman actually sees it's in Midrash Rabbah where is it? Eicha Rabbah. He sees a proof to this. This is Eicha Rabbah 9:1. It says this, it refers to Rav Acha mentions Rav Acha came to Rav Alexandri. That's his name. So you talk about Hellenism. Let's see, I'm looking in the Sansino translation here. It doesn't say anything about this name. But Alexandri, obviously, just like Tarfon. Tarfon is not exactly a Jewish name. And we dealt with this in the past. But he says to him as follows. This is what Rabbi Acha says. Comes from the next world and comes from Alexandri. He showed him three things. One of the things he showed him was there is no compartment in heaven beyond that of the martyrs of Lud, of Lida. And as Boyarin points out, Lieberman argues that the martyrs of Lida are none other than the martyrs discussed, the Christian martyrs discussed by Eusebius, where we know that the Jews saw them and felt very disappointed what they were doing. Point is that here you have an example, if Lieberman is correct, where we have preserved in the Midrash this notion that Jews showing awe, veneration almost, for Christians who gave up their life, al kiddush Hashem, so much so that they are placed in the highest level of heaven. That's one of the points that Boyarin wanted to write about in this essay in Tablet. So quite worthwhile. There's two more things I want to do before we get to the rabbinate. I think we have time. Saul Lieberman, the Orthodox. There's a couple of things I didn't mention in the back, refer to them. Among the Hebrew appendix, letters I found in the Lieberman collection, one is page 3, a letter from none other than Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski to Louis Ginsburg. Louis Ginsburg was related to Rav Chaim Ozer's wife. However, that's... it's one thing to refer to him as as professor, but he refers to him in 1935, when everyone knew what Louis Ginsberg was about. He wasn't in the so-called Orthodox world. He refers to him as Harav HaGaon. Nodel Shemel Tiferet. Why is he writing? He's writing to him because Rabbi Shlomo Hyman from Ramelas Yeshiva in Vilna, he's coming to Torah Vadas, and he's writing to let him know that to help him in any way he needs it. But you got to ask yourself, what's Rav Chaim Ozer? It's almost like Rav Chaim Ozer thought that Ginsberg, whatever his sins or sins in quotes are, because of his great learning, he gets the title. That's the sort of thing that people today would find shocking, how a gadol hador like Rav Chaim Ozer could write to Ginsberg this way. But the next letter is even more interesting. 1936, from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I actually asked Chaim Soloveitchik. I thought he might be upset with the letter. So I asked him, do you have any objection to me publishing it? And he said, no. It's a letter from his grandfather to Harav HaGaon HaGadol, none other than Levi Ginsberg. Okay, that's significant in and of itself. But what's the letter about? He says to him that I want to introduce you here. This is the letter was carried probably by Rabbi Huttner and was presented then to Ginsberg and then is in the archive. He says, I want to present to you my friend, the great Gaon, Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner from Warsaw. Now, he knew him from Warsaw. Rabbi Huttner was the tutor of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in Warsaw. And because of that relationship, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik ended up teaching at Chaim Berlin. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik taught at Chaim Berlin at the same time that he taught at YU. He'd go back and forth. I can't imagine today that such an arrangement would be allowed, but it was then. He says, I know him, that he's very talented. He's Echad Miyachidei HaSkula Ben Hador HaTzair. He's one of the great ones of the young generation. He is Talmud Chacham, the Gaon Mufak, a great Torah scholar, and complete Torah scholar. He writes Chidushim in all areas of the Torah. He's famous now because of his book, Torah to Nazir, on Tractate Nazir. And he says, because I've heard from him, that he has a matter that he wants to speak to you about. I write this to you to introduce you to him. There has long been a report, legend, that Rabbi Huttner wanted a job at the seminary. There's no evidence of that. I think that this goes back to this letter, that someone saw this letter and thought that Rav Huttner wanted to speak to Lieberman. He didn't have parnassa to have a job there. Look, anything's possible. But that's not what the letter says. Rabbi Huttner could have gone to speak to him. Rav Huttner wrote a commentary, published, I should say, Rav Hillel on Halachic Midrash, was it Sifrei, I believe. So he could have gone to speak to him about that. He could have gone to talk to him about any number of things. We know that Gedolim of all sorts, young and old, would come to speak to Ginsberg about various Torah matters because say what you will, he was the greatest expert in Yerushalmi in America then, and an expert in so many other things, Geniza, etc. So to extrapolate from a letter, a parv letter like that, that Rav Huttner wants to meet you, that he wanted a position at the seminary, that's really taking it too far. By the same token, it's reported by Spiro and Shochet, they from Finkelstein, as I recall, that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik wanted the Rav to have a position at the seminary. I find that impossible to believe that that's true. It's not the sort of thing that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik would have wanted for his son. And there's no evidence of that in the archives. Do I know for 100%? Maybe he asked Finkelstein if he could teach a course, you know, as opposed to being in the faculty. We know that if Lieberman could teach a course there and could be on the faculty, maybe the Rav could come in and teach a course. The Rav did teach non-Orthodox rabbis. There was a conservative rabbi who used to come to the Rav Shear. He's the one, I forget the name, who was the opponent of, he wrote the tshuva against non-Jewish wine. But there's no evidence. Let's put it that way. Now, the last thing I want to do, we'll take it 5 more minutes, and then we'll be done. So next class, I'll begin with, I think it'll be next, the last class, devote the whole class to the issue of the changes in the seminary, the issue, the women's issue, women's rabbinate, Lieberman's role in that. And there's a lot to say about the Orthodox world, which is changing as we speak. The last thing I want to speak about today, and it's suitable, it's fitting that it's the last thing because it was Lieberman's last article, a posthumous article. And here it is. It appeared after his death. It's called A Tragedy or a Comedy, and from the Jewish Journal of the American Oriental Society. And it was directed against this individual. Where is he? Jacob Neuser. Passed away a few years ago. As you can see, it says in Wikipedia, he was named as one of the most published authors in history, having written or edited more than 900 books. I actually think that is wrong. He wrote, I think he's probably the most published author in history, and he wrote more than 1,000 books. Unless you know of an author who wrote more. You have a list here. Where is it? Okay, let me pull it up here. They have it here. Here, Jacob Neusner bibliography. Here, you can go through it. It's beyond belief. Not to mention articles and op-eds. And Shaul Magid wrote in Tablet when a new biography about him appeared, is it time to take the most published man in human history seriously? And he refers to him as over... I think he says, yeah, more than 1,000 scholarly and popular books. So what to do with a man like with Neusner? That's because if you write it, usually when you write a biography of someone, you read all of his writings, but it's impossible to read all of his writings. The new biography on him is by Aaron Hughes. It came out in 2016. If you look in the Lieberman archives, there's letters from Neusner. Neusner was a big fan of Lieberman. Writing to him is that, I'll read you a couple passages in a second. He's the greatest of them all. So then what's going on? Why would Lieberman write such a review? Well, before we get into that, you have to know something about Neusner's personality. He was a difficult person. You know, he obviously had friends, but he would turn on people. He's known famously outside the academic world. You can read this. I don't know how anyone writes something like this, but one year around graduation time in Brown University, he wrote this. This appeared in the Brown student newspaper. It was picked up by Washington Post. A commencement speech you will never hear. And it's telling the students there that... That you have no accomplishments, you haven't learned anything, you're a bunch of quitters and snowflakes. And it's, I don't know how you tell them this at graduation. It's difficult. Now, did I have a relationship with Neusner? I did, a little bit of a relationship, and it basically models what lots of people. Lots of people have these relationships with Neusner, and then he would turn on you and he would send you these letters that said drop dead. And so at first I had a very good relationship with Neusner. I'll even prove it to you. I'm going to have to show you because for some reason I can't get this on the screen here. It's only the stuff that's, hold on. I'll get it. I can show it to you. Maybe now it'll do it. If not, I'll just show it on the screen. You'll see it. Yeah. Okay. I'll show you. I sent, in 1993, I just happened to be reading something Neusner wrote, so I sent him a letter pointing out the error he made, what I thought was an error. And he writes back to me. I get in the mail a few days later, I get this, one of his thousands of books, Foundations of Judaism, Jacob Neusner. And what does it say on the inside? Look at here. For Mark Shapiro, criticism accepted. J. Neusner, what does it say? 9293. So there we were off to a great start. And a couple of years later, he writes a review of my book on Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg, Between Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy. I send him the book because he said he wants to write a review. I send him the book. The day he gets the book, he writes the review because that night or the next day, it wasn't more than one day, he sends me a copy of the review back. I think he sent it to Congress Monthly. So he obviously didn't read the book. He skimmed it, but so he sent it to me. And again, we even had discussions of him coming to speak at the University of Scranton. Then he was publishing this encyclopedia. he asked me, would I write the entry on orthodoxy unit? And I didn't have time. And so I said to him, I'm really too busy, but I can recommend some people if you're interested, which is a typical thing to say. And that, for whatever reason, offended him. And he got very angry at me. He said, the only reason I wrote the good review for you was to, as a favor for your father, and you have a lot of chutzpah. I mean, but this was the personality that by something which was totally innocuous, he got angry with me, and that was it. And so I see it's already 9:31. So by next class, I'll begin. I just want to tell you about this review, which I think stayed with Neuser the rest of his life. It was terribly hurtful. It probably was. I don't know if anyone should write a review this harsh. And there's a why Lieberman, at the end of his life, someone who was a student, granted, not a student like Halivni or Shama Friedman, but he was a student of his, why he would write such a thing and how Neusner would attempt to get his revenge. We'll spend maybe 10 minutes on that. But I told you a story with myself just to know that Neusner, he made enormous contributions. In fact, the whole way we look at the study of the history of the Talmudic period, you have to really thank him. And he said very interesting and I think important stuff about the debasing of the humanities in America, about the rise of ethnic ghettos in ethnic studies as ghettos. I really think he had a lot to say, but in some of his scholarship, it left something to be desired. And because that he was an ornery person and difficult to get along with, you could see how this could lead to tensions, which I think will explain why Lieberman wrote the way he did. Because we saw what he wrote about Seitlin, that if you're not respecting Gedolei Yisrael, well, Neusner was not one to respect Gedolei Yisrael. On the contrary, some of the things he said about the traditional rabbis would have outraged Lieberman. Not to mention, I'm sure Lieberman was getting reports of the same thing that happened like with me, where you thought you were friends and then he turns on you with the famous drop dead letters. You can read all about it. And I think all of that, not to mention what Lieberman saw as a complete lack of scholarship in his Talmud, his translation of the Yerushalmi. I mean, Neusner's unbelievable. Yisansino, for instance, they have a whole team to translate. The Arts World has a whole team. When Neusner wants to translate the Bavli, one man, he does it all himself. The Yerushalmi, he gave a volume to this person, a volume to that person, and the rest of the volumes, he does it all himself. Where he found the time, I don't know. The problem is, look, even if it's bad quality, I still don't know where he found the time. And supposedly he liked to watch television every night by 9 o'clock. He's watching television. So I don't know how he did it. It's one of the wonders of the world that how someone, even if everything is nonsensical, just to accomplish so much, to write so much, there's only 24 hours in a day. But the quality of the translation of the Yerushalmi. Well, we'll talk. I see it's already 9:35. Oh, I went over. So we'll talk about that next time. And then we'll get into the whole, the women's issue, halachic, hashkafic, etc. Let me look at some of the comments. I think it was appropriate to tell you the story with Neusner because I'm just one story of like a million stories, and it helps to understand this most fascinating individual. You know, here's the book, Aaron Hughes, Jacob Neusner, an American Jewish Iconoclast. It's the first of, there'll be other books on Neusner. But it made it for difficulty with scholars, especially in Israel, because Neusner was in a battle with the Israeli scholars. So let me ask some of the questions. Moshe says, I just see this before I move up. L. Ron Hubbard wrote more. Did L. Ron Hubbard? Please find out while I'm answering the questions and put in the chat. How many books did L. Ron Hubbard write? Could be more. Rabbi Shibnow says, Chicago had a Palestinian kosher sausage company, later Sinai 40 and Sinai Kosher. Before the State of Israel, everything is Palestine. We know that. The significance is that even after the State of Israel, they still call it the Palestinian Talmud. Someone privately said that the Rabbi Revel and Varon Kohler both have yortzeit on the 2nd of Kislev. I know that. So someone says Rav Chaim Ozer's Levaya was also delayed, as Dovi pointed out. Let's see. Someone writes here that on the last Thursday night of his life, Those responsible for arranging the funeral Sunday were haunted by an ugly experience with the Soviets at the funeral of a Blazer. Okay, I'm not sure which funeral you're referring to there. And the CZS points out Hanukkah is menorah, same as candles called Havdalah. That's exactly what I said. Thank you for agreeing with me, but it's not Chanukiah. Moshe points out there's a concept in the Megillah Sittarim before the Mishnah too, correct? They're mentioned in the, you see this in the Gemara. Moshe says, nor did they correct the Mishnah, was determined that there was a missing component. Yeah, Chesurei Mechsura, that's a good example. Because, there's a missing part. The Vilna Gaon's position, I don't think this is drash. I think this might be pshat, actually. The Vilna Gaon says that when they say there's a Chesurei Mechsura missing, it doesn't really mean it's missing. That they're interpreting it as if it's missing. Moshe says, how does he distinguish between that and Braisa and Tosefta in terms of popularity? I think it's just that the Mishnah became the accepted one. The Toseftas are also rabbinic passages, but the Talmud never was not written on that. Susanna says, breaking the glass of the chuppah, scaring demons or something, Zecher HaChorban. Yeah, if you look in one of the old Hebrew Union College annuals, although they collected all of them, Jacob Lauterbach, he was at the HUC. He has an essay there on breaking the glass. He has two volumes of essays in one of the volumes. And he shows or argues that it really was really to scare the demons. And this idea on Zecher HaChorban comes in later. Ruth asks, what are Zugot? I thought they were the pairs of the Chamin or the Mishsora. That is another exponent, the meaning of Zugot. But Zugot are also pairs that the Gemara, the Bavli, not the Yerushalmi, the Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, says that doublets are dangerous. And the commentaries explain because the demons were attracted to this. So they would avoid twos. Don't eat two cookies. Don't do things in twos. And the Gemara in Pesachim, Narve Pesachim, has a whole discussion of this concept of Zugot. The Rambam also doesn't mention Zugot. He doesn't mention at all. iPad says that this issue of Yibum, or sacrifice or slavery, is analyzed by Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz as Torah-tolerated values versus Torah-mandated values. That is true. But Berkovitz's real contribution is more of the things like slavery, I think, that because these are really values that maybe today are problematic. But it's not just Berkovitz. It's Rav Nachum Rabinovitz says the same thing. He adopts the Rambam's model with sacrifices and applies it to other matters such as slavery. Now, I quote that because in my forthcoming book, on which will be a little more forthcoming, I think, because they want me to do a conclusion and add some other things. But I deal with this in the context of Rav Kook as well, who has an interesting perspective on it. Moshe says, would I say that the adoption of non-Jewish practices is a b'di'avad when said practices are already widely accepted, or a chachil as a fundamental Jewish approach to incorporating and making holy the mundane secular world? That's like a basic question. So obviously you have people on both sides of the matter. And it's not just practices. It's like the same question about non-Jewish wisdom. You have someone like Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch who says that l'chadchila we should be involved in Western society and incorporate this wisdom. And you have someone like Israel Hildesheimer who was just as knowledgeable as Hirsch and just as much involved in Western society and just as much advocating that we need to be involved. But he said that if we could have a society where we just had Torah, like if we could create some sort of ghetto, then that's fine. Torah only is fine. Whereas Hirsch, l'chadchila, didn't believe in it. Hildesheimer thought that it's really a b'di'avad, but since we can't have that, we need to be on top of it. It's the same thing. Rabbi Walter Wurzberger has an essay in one of the early Torah Mada journals where he raises the question, where he deals basically with what you're pointing out and how we absorb values from the non-Jewish world. But is this just something like ex post facto? Or do we acknowledge that, for example, the attentiveness we have to human rights and the importance of slavery, we are outraged, and we are outraged isn't the better word. I want a stronger word, but we find it repulsive, the idea of slavery. You can own someone. It doesn't come out directly out of Jewish texts. Now, true, you can say that it's latent, and that's the message, but we would be dishonest if we did not acknowledge, and this Gerald Blitzstein says this as well, if we did not acknowledge that we are influenced in this by values in the outside world. So if you're a follower of Cook, this makes perfect sense, because Cook believes that this is part of God's revelation, a continuing revelation, that society moves to higher and higher levels, and we move along with it, and then that causes us to see the true MS in Torah Psukim. So that's a Rav Cook perspective. I'm sure that if you were in certain Haredi circles, they would tell you that slavery is not a problem at all. It's because it's a non-Jewish value that says you shouldn't have it. So it's really comes from where your perspective is. iPad says, can you just take stuff, rule of wills, from the garden without permission? No, you can't steal it. But it's talking about, when I say take it, where's the reach of the language here? The actual language of the Shulchan Aruch is, when it says mutar litol misham, it means to take it with their permission. Either you, could you buy it? That's the question, because that would come down to whether there's a big question if you can buy something like that. Most of the time they assume that they're not going to use it for issues of avodah zarah. They'll use it to like fix a wall or something. But if the local, let's say Dominican, say, you want to come and use our, in our yard, use the willows, or hadassim, or whatever grows there. I don't know where hadassim grow, but willows grow. So then you'd be allowed to use that. Susanna says Sister Rose Thiering was influential in promoting of Vatican II. She's from this area. Perhaps Moshe says perhaps the Rama would argue if he knew what the Tzirim were. No, because why do you say that? The Rama just the Rama is explicit in the Shulchan Aruch there, Moshe. The Rama says if the tree was planted in front of idol worship, as long as they don't worship the tree, you're allowed to use it. That's what he says on that exact halacha. So the Rama wouldn't say it. After all, what's the problem? They're not worshiping it. It happens to be in their yard. Why can't you use it? It's growing in their yard. There's nothing idolatrous about it. Moshe says, the story I heard was that Heschel, I read this over because the people listening or even the ones who are watching on YouTube don't see the questions. The story I heard was that Heschel gave Lieberman a copy of Heavenly Torah, Termin HaShemayim, which was just reissued in a new edition with new stuff they found, to which Lieberman responded with a note to the effect that tracing the disputes between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael had already been done. I forget the name of the work he cited. He would have been citing Arthur Marmorstein, the grandfather of Rabbi Avraham Marmorstein from the Upper West Side. His grandfather was a scholar in the Jews College, and he wrote a book. That's the book he's referring to. Heschel returned the note, and Lieberman eventually rescinded his critique. Okay, could be. And someone privately asked, could it be that Heschel was the example of the Amma Aretz that Rabbi Soloveitchik used in his conversation with Lieberman at that bris? I don't think so, because I think they'd be speaking about a Talmudic person. But you never know. I can't tell you. You never know. I mean, Seitlin could have been. It could have been. I always thought it was Seitlin that the Rav was referring to, or someone of that nature. But maybe, I don't know. But Heschel wasn't an Amma Aretz. He wasn't a Bucky and Shas and Posim like the way these people were, but he clearly was an expert in Torah literature. Not that Titan was an Amma Aretz either. For us, he'd be considered a Godel in learning. But for people like Lieberman and the Rav, they would consider him, I think, an Amma Aretz. Barry, Rabbi Barry Hartman says that Dr. David Lukens, a Talmud of both the Rav and Rav Aaron, when the latter was at YU, arranged a debate between the two brothers regarding the Vietnam War. The Rav supported it and Rav Aaron opposed it. Atara Tversky nixed the debate. I think when you say Rav Aaron, you mean Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. But Rav Aaron I don't know if you mean Lichtenstein or Soloveitchik. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was openly opposed to the Vietnam War.
Rav Aaron Soloveitchik.
You're from Arab Salvation, okay.
Yes,
so.
But he would be sure, he told me. Yes, so the Baron Lichtenstein, but the Baron Salvation was for my time. Baron was in my time, and I know he opposed the war.
Yes, he opposed the war, and everyone knew he opposed the war. I guess that's unfortunate they didn't have the debate, because that would have been an interesting debate.
Dave Lugan said to me that Torah said to him, no, you're not going to put this now. The brothers are arguing about this. No, no, no. They wanted, by the way, the Rav Navarin wanted to do it. They were masking to David Lugans. The Torah Tversky spoke to him. She said, our father spoke to her uncle, and they agreed with the Torah.
I'll tell you, since you met David Lugans, his brother lives in Scranton. So I know his brother, but at the Shiva of the Rav, when I went to the Shiva a couple of times, I brought over the letters, the faxes that were coming into the Center for Jewish Studies to Professor Tversky. All the people from Israel, they didn't have faxes at the houses then, so they were sending the faxes into to Harvard, so they gave it to me. I was there once, and Dr. Lukens, David Lukens, was there, and he was telling stories. He told a story once that Moynihan, Senator Moynihan, after reading something the Rav wrote, said that it's beyond him. Like, it's, and as Lukens, it's genius. And Lukens said, if someone like Moynihan, who apparently, I mean, I know he's a big intellectual and thought highly of himself, I'm told. If someone like Moynihan thought that it was above him, then that's like a big kavod. So Abba says, where can we get more information on Se'irim? All you have to do is Google Mark Shapiro, Se'irim in Hebrew, and you should get the blog post where I gave all the sources on this. Although I have new sources on it. David Zinberg sent me sources, and I found other sources. Nothing really significant, just the more Rishonim. That was the term. The Rishonim all used this term. They all knew what it meant. But over the centuries, people have forgotten. And obviously, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't know what the Se'irim are. But he knows that it's something to do with the church. The truth is that if I tell most people, even most people probably listening, I say this Franciscans, Dominicans, I don't think most people know what the Franciscans, Dominicans are either. They know it's something having to do with the Catholic Church, but what's a Franciscan? What's a Dominican? What's a Jesuit? What's a diocesan priest? What's the difference? I don't think most people know what that is either, but okay. Moshe says, does he identify the specific sect of Christians martyred? I don't know. We have to see the, I don't think so. As I recall, no, I don't. You'd have to look in the articles there. Someone privately says, check out Paul Hugo. Who's Paul Hugo? And his pseudonyms on chess and other things. He wrote, I guess, more works than Lieberman. Okay. I want a couple more. I hear someone. I don't know who it is, though. If you can pause, silence yourself, because you're getting feedback. Yaakov Yellen says, there's an old joke about Lieberman that perhaps I've heard. Someone calls to speak to him, and the secretary responds, sorry, Professor Neusner is busy writing a book. And the caller says, that's okay, I'll wait. Yes. But just again, to return to Neusner, when you agree, his political things he writes, I guess this shows my politics, perhaps, but I think university politics, he's really on to something. And he saw, before many others did, that the debasement of the humanities. He's not around today to see the further debasement of the humanities, but he saw the beginning of the debasement and he refused to be a part of it. And he's one of these people that just spoke his mind. He, in terms of writing books, Yaakov, he wrote a few different like memoirs of sorts. And in one of them, he says that he battled always the presidents of his universities. The president of Brown says to him, you know, how do you write so damn much? And Neusner takes offense at that and says, like, basically, why does everyone else write so damn little? That sort of thing. And I don't know how he did it. So Moshe says that Neusner wrote 1,084 books according to the Guinness Book. So you're saying, Moshe, that the Guinness Book of World Records has Neusner as the most authored book in history? And remember, he has to read too. He can't just write. So maybe he's not reading enough. That's a criticism. But he is reading. To translate the Talmud, he has to read it, even if it's a mistaken translation. He has to, if he's criticizing Lieberman, he has to read the works. Where he found the time, I don't know.
No, he's saying Hubbard wrote that many books.
Oh, Hubbard wrote, the Neusner's over 1,000. So we have to see how many it is. It's close. Now, some of Neusner's works are books, they're collections of his essays, but still. Rabbi Shundo says, Avdut is servitude, better than slavery is a translation. I don't know. I'm not sure what the difference of servitude and slavery is, not to mention the fact that there's two types of slaveries. We have Eved Ivri, which is sort of like a... servants of a sort. But Evid Kanani is, if you look at the laws of Evid Kanani, it would fall into the category of everything you think slavery is, real slavery, like in the South. Now, it doesn't mean you have to treat them bad. The Rambam tells you, you have to treat them properly, but not everyone in the South treated the slaves poorly. But in terms of what it meant, the status of a slave and his freedoms, that is real avdus. Three more things. Moshe says, the Mishnah Berurah and Hilchos Sisos talk about the rewards for a mitzvah, having abundance of slaves after the time of Mashiach. So someone like Rav Kook would say, not just Rav Kook, I can't really imagine anyone today sees this as something that's a positive thing. Rav Kook, although he speaks about emerging morality, in his day, he writes about how slavery can be seen as better than the way the workers were treated in, let's say, think back to the sweatshops, because at least you had a master who wanted to make sure you didn't get sick. Again, I call your attention to Rabbi Rabinovich and others developing morality, which they think is internal to Torah. And Moshe says the Rama holds Christianity is not idolatry. That is correct. We spoke about this a few semesters ago. Christianity for the Rama is shituf, that associationism, however you want to translate this, that you can believe in one God divided into different parts as opposed to two separate gods. That is the Rama's position. So you were saying that he would argue on the whole premise. Not necessarily, because the Rama holds that it's idolatry for Jews. It's just not idolatry for non-Jews. So it is still idolatry. So that would be, if this is a piece of idolatry as far as we're concerned, it would not be. Heschel and Lieberman, Moshe says, you see this book by Kaplan. Very nice. Thank you. Charlotte says he thinks Neuser and others translate for him and then reworked it. I think the Bavli translation, because it would have come out. I've never heard anyone say that I wrote it yet. In the Yerushalmi, he had other people who translated it and he looked it over. But I don't know about the Bavli. If you know differently, let me know. And Charlotte says she could have translated, but declined, felt it was too much. Yeah, because usually translations are hard work and takes a long time. But if you have any evidence that other people, like graduate students, that's the old accusation sometimes, that people use their graduates. But Neuser didn't do that with his graduate students. He actually treated his graduate students very well. He published books and included essays from his graduate students. I've never heard any story that he abused his graduate students or had them write stuff, which then he took credit for. I just think that Neuser could give 10 people a tractate, and he does the rest of the tractates. Remember, he did the whole Bavli himself, and the Yerushalmi, he split it up. Thank you all very much. One more class, God willing. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Okay.